caffeine, caffeine. Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If Alice Cooper singing the praises of caffeine didn't wake you up, maybe a steaming cup of the real thing will. 63 million Americans slug down at least one cup every morning. But the caffeine in our coffee, sodas, and energy drinks is a real drug with real health consequences, and it goes largely unregulated. Joining us now is journalist and author of a new book on the topic, Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. He joins us by phone from Belfast, Maine. Welcome to the show, Murray Carpenter.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I know it comes from a bean because I grind them every morning, but what is caffeine?
Well, it often comes from a bean. That's how we get most of our caffeine in the American diet, is from the coffee bean. But it's a simple chemical compound that occurs naturally in plants all over the world. In Africa, in Asia, in South America, in different plants. And its primary function in the plant seems to be as an insecticide. But wherever it occurs, people have quickly learned that it functions as a stimulant and have put it to use as such.
What are some other, are there any of those sources of caffeine that you could name that would be familiar to most of us?
Yeah, sure. So in Central America, where we have the earliest physical evidence of the human use of caffeine, it was used in chocolate, in frothy chocolate drinks. So chocolate does have caffeine, although the milk chocolate bars we commonly consume today don't have much caffeine because they don't have really much of the cocoa in them. But and then in Africa, it's not only in the coffee plant, but also in cola nuts. And then, of course, in Asia, it occurs in tea and has been used for thousands of years to brew the tea leaves in water to produce the mildly stimulating beverage that's beloved in Asia.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Murray Carpenter. He's the author of a new book. It's called Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. If you have a question about caffeine, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is the caffeine that we're talking about the same sort of caffeine that's in soda and energy drinks? I imagine that's not the caffeine from the coffee bean.
Well, that's interesting. So you can produce caffeine different ways. We can take it in its natural form from coffee. You can extract the naturally occurring caffeine from coffee and blend that into sodas, which is one way that that bottlers do it. You can also synthesize caffeine in a pharmaceutical plant from its chemical precursors, and that's actually the largest source of caffeine now for the soft drink industry. But however you produce it, whether you extract it from a naturally occurring product or synthesize it in a pharmaceutical plant, it's the same drug, and it will have the same effect on the human body.
All right. So what, I know it helps perk me up in the morning, and everybody knows that, but what exactly is it doing to the body?
Well, the primary function, and you're right, perking you up, it tends to simply make us feel better. I mean, that's one of the things we notice. It perks us up and makes us feel good. The primary way that this happens is that caffeine blocks a neurotransmitter called adenosine, and adenosine basically serves to tell the body when we're a little bit tired. And caffeine can sit in the neuroreceptors where adenosine should go and block adenosine from doing its work. And when we're fully caffeinated, so for most people, if you've had two cups of coffee in the morning, you're actually blocking half of the adenosine receptors in your brain.
Now, is there anything wrong with blocking those receptors?
There doesn't seem to be. I mean, for moderate caffeine use in most people, there's nothing to indicate that it's unhealthy over the long haul. Nothing to suggest that it harms your brain health or harms your cardiovascular system. There are some people who are going to be, very sensitive to caffeine's effects. And, the best known problems associated with caffeine use are sleeplessness or insomnia and anxiety. And for some people, this can be a very real problem caused or triggered by caffeine.
Well, that the insomnia has to do with the fact that perhaps they're drinking it too close to bedtime?
Yeah, typically. Now, it's really interesting how much genetic variability there is. I mean, I think we probably all know people who can sort of have a tall cup of coffee after dinner and go off to sleep and sleep like babies, whereas most of us, that wouldn't work so well. But there's even some indication that a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, maybe 200 milligrams of caffeine, just what most of us would have early in the day, might affect the later stages of your sleep the following morning. So not the sort of thing where you're sort of tossing and turning in bed, but that your the later stages of your sleep might not be as heavy as if you had not had caffeine. So it has the acute effect we're aware of, but it can also have more subtle effects on sleep.
What is the connection between caffeine and headaches that you get when you skip that morning coffee?
Yeah, wow. This is a really interesting area of caffeine, because for some people, caffeine can actually trigger headaches. But for most of us, the most common association with caffeine is this withdrawal headache. So if you're a habitual caffeine user and you skip your coffee one morning and you start to feel a headache, what seems to be going on is that caffeine is a vasoconstrictor, and when you skip your caffeine, those blood vessels close to the surface of the brain might actually be becoming engorged a little bit, giving you a slightly throbbing headache. So it's unpleasant, but that's what's going on. But it's worth noting that caffeine is also a very effective headache treatment it's blended into headache pills for people who suffer from migraines, and it's also a key ingredient in Anacin and Excedrin.
What are some other things that caffeine is in that we might not realize? I know, of course, energy drinks, and I want to talk about that, but is there anything else that caffeine's in that maybe we just don't realize it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of people associate caffeine with sodas, but particularly with cola-flavored mm-hmm. sodas. But it's also in a lot of others. Mountain Dew, I think most people know that it has caffeine because it sort of positioned itself as a mildly stimulating drink.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the advertising all seems to suggest that.
Yeah.
But also Sunkist, you know, an orange soda. I think that surprises a lot of people because, you know, we think of orange sodas like Fanta as not being caffeinated.
But Sunkist does.
Yeah, Sunkist is moderately caffeinated, so between the level of Coke and the Mountain Dew.
So energy drinks have become very popular, and I wanted to talk about those. How much caffeine do they contain? Are they more heavily caffeinated than, say, my cup of Joe in the morning?
Well, probably not, and this is one of the common misunderstandings. Now, it's worth noting, energy drink levels vary from, like, 80 milligrams all the way up to over 300, but nearly all of those that are most popular have either 80 milligrams, which is the small can of Red Bull that's so popular, mm-hmm. like the 8-ounce can mm-hmm. you see everywhere. But then the Monsters and Rock Stars, the other popular energy drinks, which are 16 ounces and are really hugely popular, those contain about twice as much, so 160 milligrams. But that, you know, for a coffee drinker, you know, that's really not much more than is in, say, a 10-ounce or 12-ounce cup of coffee. It's probably less than a 12-ounce cup of coffee, and it's certainly far less than you would get in a strong 16-ounce cup of coffee.
I read that it's not a requirement that food manufacturers list the caffeine content on labels. Why is that?
That's a funny thing. It really is. So they are required to list it as an ingredient. You know, if caffeine's added, it should say caffeine. It's just been for a long time. FDA has never required the quantity to be labeled, and you know, when it was only blended into soft drinks at lower levels, this hasn't been as much of a concern for consumers. But now that the energy drinks are incorporating more caffeine, a lot of people are hoping that FDA, in its current sort of investigation of energy drinks, will require better labeling. And it's worth noting that the largest bottlers are now are voluntarily labeling the quantities. So Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, Snapple are voluntarily labeling the amount of caffeine in their products.
Wait a minute. Snapple has caffeine in it?
No. The company, though, that produces Dr. Pepper and other brands is now known as Dr. Pepper Snapple.
Okay. Some coffee shops like Starbucks list the caffeine content in their drinks, but you say that's not necessarily accurate.
It ranges so widely that I think it's good to give consumers an idea of what's in coffee, but it's important to let them know also that it's an approximation. And one of the things that it surprises most of us is that a single cup of Starbucks one day could have twice as much coffee as the exact same blend, the exact same size from the exact same cafe the day before. And this, you know, there's a bunch of variables here. One is that it's a natural product. The caffeine in the coffee bean could vary from batch to batch. But brewing strength, of course, will also have something to do with this, the ratio of beans to water.
It's hard, like you said, to manufacture something with a consistent amount, right? Is this true with the soft drinks and the power drinks and all that kind of stuff, too?
Not at all. So, yeah, with energy drinks, they essentially what they're doing is they're taking a very specific quantity of the pure drug form of caffeine, the bitter white powder, and blending it into these products. So the bottlers know exactly how much caffeine is in each bottle or can of soda or energy drink, and so labeling should not be any challenge at all for them.
So it's a bitter white powder. It's comforting to know that at least it is bitter. Like, you know, coffee can be bitter, and I often wonder, how do we ever get addicted to this stuff in the first place, which I am now? And I love coffee, and I'm very picky about what I drink and what water I use and everything. But how do we get it? Is it that powerful of a drug that the taste doesn't matter?
I think you're really on to something there. Yes, I think the short answer is yes, it's that powerful. And the reason we know this is because those of us who think, oh, I just like coffee because of the way it tastes, that doesn't explain. It doesn't explain a lot. It doesn't explain why in Africa, you know, people are chewing cola nuts, or in, you know, parts of South America, people walk around with thermoses of yerba mate over their shoulders all day long, and tea is popular elsewhere. I think, you know, even if we don't have great tasting coffee, which many of us are fussy about, we would probably be finding caffeine somewhere else.
Is there any way to know how much is a safe amount? I hear people, there's a guy at work here, I won't name names, but he drinks many cups of coffee all day long.
Well, and this is a really hard question. And part of the problem is what I alluded to earlier. We all process caffeine at different rates. So there's just a tremendous amount of variability. So, you know, one of us, if we drank as much coffee as your coworker, might never sleep. And some people have one cup of decaf, you know, maybe 12 milligrams of caffeine, and they're utterly wired. So it's really hard to say what's safe. That said, moderate consumption is often considered 300 to 400 milligrams a day. So like 3 to 4 6-ounce cups of coffee. And most people tolerate that well. If you don't have trouble with sleeplessness, if you're not anxious, if you're not pregnant, and you're happy with that level of caffeine consumption, there's nothing to suggest it's a health risk.
We have an email from Megan. She says, what effects do caffeine have on exercising? Does it help or hurt a workout, and should you drink it before or after?
So I would say help. That's one of the things that I got into in the book. I went to watch the Ironman in Hawaii and followed some of the athletes, because most endurance athletes are using caffeine much more systematically than in the past to enhance their performance. One of the interesting things is a moderate dose of caffeine, like your listener might take before they go to the gym, say a cup of coffee, will help them to work out more vigorously and probably increase their power a little bit. So, before a workout tends to be good. There's some indication that maybe after a workout, caffeine will help with glycogen storage, but you would have to take a lot of caffeine. So I guess a bit of caffeine before a workout or before an athletic event will probably help you exercise more vigorously.
Now, when I was pregnant, I had a couple cups of coffee every morning, and my OB just said, cut back to one. So what are the dangers? He thought the withdrawal thing would be more harmful than one cup a day.
Yeah, well, right. And that's probably great advice. So the dangers are there at higher levels, there's an association between caffeine and miscarriages, and even at lower levels with babies being small for their birth weight, for their gestational age. So the common guidance seems to be to cut back to about 200 milligrams or less. There's even new research, though, out of Scandinavia that suggests that even at 200 milligrams, babies may not be growing quite as big as the babies delivered that uncaffeinated mothers deliver. But the shorter answer is yes, moderating, cutting back, or even quitting caffeine during pregnancy is probably a good idea.
Marie Carpenter, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Marie Carpenter, he's the author of a new book. It's called Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Time was when bicycles had wooden seats, metal tires, and no brakes. Today, titanium frames, ergonomic saddles, and hydraulic brakes have enhanced the experience, making bicycling an increasingly popular recreational sport. Besides the traffic, loose dogs, and crummy weather, there's no excuse not to hop on and take a spin. And it's healthy, right? Joining us now is the chair of the editorial board at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So it's almost bicycling season is almost upon us, despite the inch of snow that was dumped on us in an hour last night. But we're not thinking about that right now. If you're looking to lose weight, I mean, in general, is cycling a good way to go? Good way to burn calories?
It is. The caveat is it all depends on how you cycle. If you are coasting most of the time and barely making up a sweat when you do it, then the answer is not much. But for most people, on average, you'll burn about 400 or 500 calories an hour, which is really good. And vigorous cycling, you can burn about 800 calories an hour. So the answer is yes.
Is there more benefit to just calorie burning? I mean, isn't it good just to get out there and get the legs moving?
Oh, there are a lot of other benefits to cycling besides that, sure. I think cycling outside has a big advantage that people often don't think of, and that is it really helps you with your balance. And for people as they age, balance becomes an issue in terms of falls. So cycling is a good prophylactic against falling in that sense, and improving your balance. So that's worth considering as well. Plus, just psychologically, bicycling allows you to traverse large areas that are often diverse and interesting, so you get stimulated by being in your environment. It's good psychologically as well as physically.
Is there a better, as far as fitness goes, option? But is it better outside, or what about indoor, the stationary bike indoors?
Well, there are pros and cons. the advantage of indoors is, well, first of all, you can do it all year round, which is nice. Secondly, you can set the difficulty to increase your activity, to increase your calorie burning, to increase your aerobic activity. That's often hard to do when you're cycling outside. So you have a little more control over how much exercise you're going to be doing. On the other hand, outside, you've got the wind resistance, which increases the work you're going to do. So that adds to the advantage of being outside. You know, I think it's really a toss-up. It's what you like the most. One of the things I like about doing it inside is that I can plug my audiobook in and listen to books as I'm cycling inside. And you really shouldn't do that if you're cycling outside, because that's a good way to get in an accident.
We've had another tragic bicycle accident in in central Ohio recently, losing another avid cyclist in the process. A car hit this person. That's what's typical. How much, when you look at cycling overall, do you factor in the dangers of being on the road?
A lot. I really factored in a lot. Last year, in 2010, there were over 500,000 visits to an emergency room in the United States because of cycling accidents, and there were 800 deaths reported. So it is a dangerous activity. One of my medical partners, a deer ran out in front of her when she was coming down a hill. She went right over her handlebars, split her helmet in half, had a bad concussion in spite of her having a helmet, but survived that. Another good friend didn't survive, that I lost several years ago to a biking accident hitting her head. So I think it's a dangerous activity in many respects. You have to be really careful with it. You can't do it casually. And, you know, some people, we talk a lot about driving and drinking. Well, some people bicycle and drink, which is really nuts. About a fourth of the people killed in that 800-person statistic I gave you were inebriated at the time they were cycling.
Have you looked into the benefits of spin class? I know that that is not a casual workout. It's one of the toughest workouts I've ever done.
Yeah, I've actually avoided it.
Well, I do too now.
it's a great exercise. It really is. The caveat to spinning is that make sure that the people who are directing you know what they're doing, that they're experienced. If you have low back problems in particular, it can exacerbate that. So just know what you're doing and getting into and do it with an experienced instructor.
But boy, they can really push you, can't they?
They sure can, yeah. You could do it to yourself on a bicycle too, of course, but it's easier when somebody's pushing you.
The seat makes a huge difference as far as how long you want to stay on your bike. There have been huge improvements with seats, but ultimately it's, you know, it is what it is.
It is what it is. The improvements have made a big difference. We've seen problems with, for men in particular, in terms of getting an erection after bicycling for long periods of time. These were primarily in the older seats, but that's due to pressure on some of the nerves in what's called the perineal area of the body. So there are attendant problems with that, but on the whole, the seats really now are much better.
Well, let's turn to food. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. My guest right now is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. We're talking about a variety of topics, breakfast coming up, bugs, indoor tanning, phosphorus. So if you have a question and want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. I had oatmeal and bananas. I just don't think that was enough. So the phrase breakfast is the most important meal of the day sounds familiar to almost everybody, I bet. But you write that the evidence on this isn't actually that convincing.
Well, like you, I've been told since I was a little kid, which was a long time ago, that you've got to eat breakfast, the most important meal of the day. And I never really liked breakfast that much. And as an adult, I stopped eating breakfast years ago. And I think I'm healthy still.
Do you eat an early lunch?
No, I found that if I ate breakfast early, I'd get hungry earlier. So I tended to avoid breakfast. Now, I will say I do have my coffee in the morning, but that's all I would have. And then I have lunch pretty much the regular time and dinner pretty much the regular time, and that seems to work for me. People should really find what works for them because science really doesn't help us very much. I looked into that in terms of where's the data that supports the idea that breakfast is the most healthy meal or skipping breakfast is really bad for your health. And there's not a lot of science to support it.
The cereal companies, right?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, interestingly, not surprisingly, the cereal companies sponsored a lot of the studies. And interestingly, those studies tended to show that breakfast was really important. But what was even more interesting, besides the obvious financial implications of the research, was that even researchers who were independent of the cereal companies had a bias. When we looked at what the researchers believed as opposed to what the science showed, we saw a direct correlation between the science that they did correlating with their beliefs. And this is not a new phenomenon. It's called the confirmational bias. And it means that we all have a bias. Usually it's unconscious, and it tends to influence the results that we get in a lot of scientific studies. That's a little frightening. So the bottom line was that the researchers who believed that breakfast was the most important meal tended to do research that supported their beliefs.
And what we have for breakfast anyway doesn't matter either, really, does it? If you
well,
do
it
want
does
to eat breakfast, well, of course, that besides that, though, if you want to eat it, does it matter if you're having it at breakfast or not?
No, not at all. Yeah, I was in Taipei at a conference last summer, and the breakfasts there were very much like lunches and dinner that I would have, and people looked quite healthy there. And actually, I enjoyed having some of those foods in the morning. So, no, it all depends upon what you like. That's how I would look at it. We've been acculturated to believe that cereals are appropriate in the morning, eggs, bacon, toast, appropriate in the morning. And then as the day goes on, you eat different things. But that's purely culture.
Is there any evidence that eating breakfast could be bad for you?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Just
not
checking.
At all. and it's a good, you know, it's a good opportunity, frankly, I love oatmeal, and it's a great opportunity, for example, to get a lot of fiber. You can get very healthy foods with the breakfast, particularly if you stay away from the cereals with sugar added, and adding some fruit, some milk. It's a very healthy meal you can create out of breakfast.
Let's move on to bugs. For dinner,
okay.
More appetite suppressant talk.
You uh-huh.
recently wrote about the benefits of eating insects, which for a lot of people sounds pretty gross. There is Mark Berman, often a guest on the show and a regular listener. He might be out there right now. He thinks bugs are great because that's what he does, is study bugs. But realistically, what's good about bugs?
You know, realistically, a lot. From an ecological standpoint, it requires a quarter of the amount of feed to create a pound of protein from bugs as opposed to from beef. Lot less pollution to grow to get adequate protein from bugs than from beef. So that's a big one right there. There's a lot of protein in bugs. There was a really interesting report from the Food and Agricultural Organization that discussed how much protein you can get, and frankly, it could make a big difference in terms of the world's population. And there's iron, zinc, copper, potassium, B vitamins, other micronutrients as well. And there's a lot of fiber in bugs from the chitin in their shells. So they're actually quite healthy.
Do you think...
I know. You just don't like the aesthetics of it.
I know more and more people do, and I know there's restaurants that are starting to include bugs on their menu. I'm trying to be open-minded about it because I know that it matters going forward to our ecosystem and to feeding the people in 2050, which is supposed to be apparently many, many people out there having to eat. But do you think there'll be a time when Americans will be as likely to open a bag of grasshoppers as potato chips?
I wouldn't be surprised, although... Grasshoppers, maybe. I mean, they do that in Mexico now, and it's considered a real good snack food. But I think what you'll be seeing is ground-up bugs made into powder and then put into different things that are prepared, because that will add a lot of protein and nutrition without the aesthetic problem that we've been talking about.
No picking wings out of our teeth and that sort of
thing.
Yeah,
exactly. So I suspect we'll see much more of that, although we'll see some of the other, too. You know... if you think about caviar and you think about shrimp and lobster, you know, a lot of people think, ooh, that's disgusting to eat those things. As a matter of fact, lobster in some cultures are called the cockroaches of the sea.
Bottom feeders, right.
Yeah. So I think it's all what you grow up with and all what you're taught. It's estimated that around 2 billion people regularly eat bugs.
So there must be something. Yeah, it is a lot of people. And there's always plenty of bugs. But on the other hand, there's lots of pesticides, too, and a lot of reasons why we have to worry about our bug populations.
I'm really glad you brought that up. It's a terribly important point. There's essentially no regulation on how these bugs are grown and processed. And they can certainly concentrate a lot of environmental toxins. So if we're really serious about increasing how we use bugs in our diet, which I suspect we will be for the reasons we talked about, mm-hmm. I think the USDA is going to have to put some strict guidelines in terms of making sure that we don't get a lot of those environmental toxins.
Let's turn to indoor tanning. It's still cold here. Very cold, actually, but there are always people who have a glow year-round thanks to tanning beds. Now more and more, I wonder how many of them are getting using safer tanning products. But it turns out that tanning is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It has not been harmed by a lot of the evidence that's come out over the years about the damages and the dangers of the UV rays.
It hasn't been harmed as much as it should be, and I'll discuss why I say that in a moment. The big reason it hasn't been harmed as much is that there's been a tremendous amount of money put in by this, as you mentioned, multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry to lobby the government to not have regulations on it. And they've been, to some extent, successful. One of the lobbying groups was shut down a couple years ago, but another one just popped up. So there's a lot of money behind this. But there's a lot of danger to tanning, and I think that my message to your listeners is avoid it.
The tanning industry is saying that it's actually good for you, generates vitamin D.
This is the old strategy that the tobacco industry used back in the 50s and early 60s, and that was they argued that it was one of the arguments they had was that it was smoking cigarettes were good for you. And then it forced people to have to prove them wrong that it was good for you, much less proving how harmful it was. So they changed the argument a lot. And that's what the tanning industry is doing now. They're using the tobacco strategy. And that is they're claiming that it increases your vitamin D. It's good for you. So come in and it's going to give you more vitamin D, which is going to cure this, that, and the other, which is really nonsense on a couple levels. One is the ultraviolet rays that are primarily used in the tanning salons are not the rays, that's the UVA, that stimulate vitamin D production. And number two, if you need vitamin D, it's very easy to get it by just taking a supplement. So there's no reason you have to expose yourself to a carcinogen, that is tanning, the ultraviolet light, to get vitamin D when you can easily get it and safely with a supplement if you're not getting enough in your diet.
Is the sun that we're exposed to today the same sun we were exposed to 50 years ago?
I hope so.
Well, it's the same sun, but I should say...
In terms of the environment?
The environment, I should say, the impact of it.
In terms of safety?
Yeah.
I can't really answer that question precisely. There's some evidence that there may be more UVA and more UVB because of the change in the environment, but that's really soft data.
Okay.
I don't think that's a big issue.
Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks for joining us today. It's always so nice to have you on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr.
Bye-bye.
John Swartzberg, bye-bye. Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Coming up, we're going to talk about health care and how it's working for you. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. TV psychologist Dr. Phil often asks his guests this signature question, how's that working for you? It's a little glib, but it forces you to weigh the evidence, and it's the spirit behind a recent movement in delivering health care. Evidence-based practice combines the concerns and expertise of all parties involved in health care decisions, doctors, researchers, and patients. And here to tell us how it's working is Bernadette Melnick, Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
So give us a definition of evidence-based practice.
Evidence-based practice is a problem-solving approach to the way we deliver care that integrates the best evidence from research, combines that with our clinical expertise and patients' preferences and values. So constantly, those three major factors need to be integrating together to make the best clinical decisions.
Let's take an example of an ailment and just walk us through how that would, those would be woven together. Let's say a bad headache.
A bad headache, a earache. So we can take any of those particular conditions. We could take asthma. Let me give you an example for that. If you're a parent of a child who has asthma and you take your child to the emergency department, you are probably, your child is going to be giving a bronchodilator to deal with them having difficulty breathing.
So it would treat the symptom.
Exactly. And most emergency departments give that medication with a nebulizer instead of a metered dose inhaler and a spacer. We have tons of evidence to show that bronchodilators given with a spacer and metered dose inhaler lead to less time in the emergency room, less side effects of the medication, and less admissions to the hospital. Yet, we have a lot of emergency departments still using nebulizers throughout the country. So I could give you many examples. I'll give you another one.
So a patient comes in with their mom or dad, and the mom says they're using a nebulizer, and she can ask, why are you using a nebulizer? Is there another way to deliver the dose of that we need for this condition?
Exactly.
And they should be able to say, well, we use a nebulizer because.
That's exactly right. I think, remember, people trust their healthcare providers. And oftentimes they don't feel comfortable to ask for the evidence behind the screening tests that are ordered, the medications, the treatments that's being ordered. So it's critical that people feel comfortable enough and advocate enough in asking questions about what's the evidence behind? What does the data support in this case?
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me right now is Bernadette Melnick, Dean of the College of Nursing at OSU. We're talking about evidence-based practice, and it involves the patient. Very, very much involves the patient. If you have an example of when you participated in evidence-based practice where you questioned the evidence behind a treatment you were receiving and got the answer you were looking for, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is this different from what healthcare professionals are used to? You know, haven't they always had to balance patient values with medical opinions and research? And I guess I'm asking that you're the dean of nursing at OSU. A lot of times nurses are doing, even though they're extremely well-trained and well-educated, are doing what they've always done or what somebody's told them to do.
That's exactly right. I think if you ask nurses, physicians, a lot of healthcare providers these days, you know, sometimes they get steeped with this is the culture in this institution. This is how we do it here. We also know, Anne, that one reason why people aren't practicing in this way, let's take, for example, nurses, is because educational programs continue to teach students the rigorous process of how to conduct research versus how to use the research that's being produced. In fact, we have an old saying in healthcare that it takes, on average, 17 years to translate findings from research into clinical practice to improve care and patient outcomes. Knowing doesn't translate into doing.
How much of what we see done in a hospital, say when you enter the emergency room, is a culture driven by nurses versus doctors versus where does it come from, what's decided to do when?
Well, it is. It's organizational philosophy. It's the culture that's created. But what we do know through research, you can have a provider who's been educated to deliver evidence-based care, but if they walk into a culture or a hospital environment where they don't support that to its fullest extent, those behaviors probably aren't going to sustain because people slip back into that's the way we do it here.
That's the way we've always done it. So say the mother says, why are you giving a nebulizer instead of an inhaler? And they'll say, well, that's the way we've always done it. The kid's having an asthma attack. What do you do?
Yeah, that's a real tough position to be in.
Because maybe the nurse doesn't know why they're doing it.
Well, exactly.
Or the technician or whoever's.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think the important piece here is to keep asking for the evidence behind what you're being given as a treatment or what somebody is recommending to you. And it's important you understand that evidence. I almost lost my youngest daughter in Australia 9 years ago. She almost died from a ruptured appendix because people were not practicing evidence-based healthcare. And now here's a real important point. You had mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that patients' preference and values need to be integrated into evidence-based clinical decisions. Even though I am a pediatric nurse practitioner, have seen thousands of children over the course of my career, and knew my daughter was in early appendicitis, nobody would take my preference and my perception of what was going on into consideration. And I'm a healthcare provider. So I always tell folks, you know, folks who aren't healthcare providers, it's easier for me to advocate because I have knowledge and skills behind. But for the average person, they don't have that background.
So who are you talking to then right now? You want the patients to ask for the information, but if the nurse or whoever the technician says, I don't know why we do it this way, are you supposed to tell them, well, don't do it until you know why? Or
I would say I'd like to speak with someone who could answer this question for me, because I really need to know what's the best evidence behind what you're telling me to have done. You know, there's a lot of controversy that has come out recently about screening. And have we overscreened for certain conditions? Because we have a group called the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which I served on for 4 years. The purpose of that task force is to review all the evidence behind primary care screening tests. Now, we put out gold standard evidence-based recommendations for what people should have done in terms of screening tests. But so many primary care providers don't follow those guidelines. You can produce all the wonderful guidelines you want, but that doesn't mean that translates into behavior change by providers.
When you're talking to professionals in the medical field about this topic, what kind of reaction do you get from them? I'm sure you get nodding heads in the audience, but there's got to be some pushback, too.
People know we have to move in this direction. Even the Affordable Care Act says in it that third-party payers, reimbursers, have to reimburse providers for the recommendations by the United States Preventive Services Task Force. So more recognition for evidence-based practices out there. But again, there's multiple barriers to why everybody doesn't consistently practice in this way.
I would imagine the medical field and the options out there are moving so fast now. It's got to be difficult to keep up with the latest and know all the options for every kind of treatment you're going to give, especially in an emergency room situation.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right about the evidence coming out so quickly. But again, in evidence-based practice, we teach the steps, the process. So we are able to help clinicians to ask questions in a certain format that leads to their ability to search for the evidence in a quicker way, to critically evaluate that evidence. We call that critical appraisal, and integrate it into their decision making. So there's really a stepped process that we teach in terms of how to come out and consistently deliver evidence-based care.
So you're teaching evidence-based care in medical schools now?
Medical schools, nursing schools, but again, several colleges aren't teaching evidence-based practice. They're teaching research, but that is different than evidence-based care.
So when you talk about teaching research, what are they doing differently? How does that differ again?
They're teaching the scientific process of how to conduct research versus how to take an evidence-based approach to care and use the research.
What about continuing education courses? Are nurses required to do those? I know doctors are.
Yeah.
Nurses too. And is that part of that palette of options when they go out to do continuing ed?
In several states, they require continuing education for nurses. As in Ohio, it is required. Uh-huh. What I want to emphasize here, though, too, we did a national study just last year on the state of evidence-based practice in United States nurses. Uh-huh. We found disheartedly that the older the nurse, the less desire and interest they had in gaining more knowledge and skills in evidence-based practice.
Were you surprised by that?
Somewhat, but again,
I can imagine being disheartened by it, but surprised?
I was more surprised when we asked, what are the biggest barriers to you practicing this way? Number one was the misperception of it takes too much time. Hmm. Two was organizational culture and politics. That's the way we do it here. But number five, which was the first time this had ever been identified in the literature, was nurse manager and leader resistance.
Which will be the more senior people on the staff.
Correct. So I think there are, again, there's many barriers that we continue to have in our healthcare systems that block people from consistently practicing in this way.
We have an email from Mary Jo. She says, but evidence is based on one size fits all, right? I am really scared of evidence-based care because it eliminates treatments which might work for people who are very far from the 170-pound male that most evidence is based on. I think that's a good point.
I think that is an excellent point. But what you have to remember is evidence-based practice takes into consideration three major factors. Yes, one is the evidence based on research that's done, and sample sizes are often homogeneous, like you're talking about with this male that you've just presented. too, but it's also based on a clinician's expertise and what the patient values and wants. And those should be taken seriously when considering clinical decisions.
Bernadette Melnick, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Bernadette Melnick is the Dean of the College of Nursing, Associate Vice President for Health Promotion, and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.